How did you get into theatre then? I think I know your story a bit. It's with that theatre company, Theater Fahotsi.
Saw a play, The Gods Are Not to Blame, at the Arcola Theatre.
Okay.
And
Olorotimiji,
yeah. And I was just, I watched it and I was just like, this is Nigeria on stage. I mean, it's the first time I'd ever seen a full production of anything. So to just see that and to go, that's my culture, that's my language, that's what I know at home. Yeah, I wanted to just do that.
And this theatre company, it's dedicated to work by Africans in Britain.
Yeah, Africans in Britain. And African story. So we've all written... Have you done a...
I've been
a
theatre before.
No, I haven't.
So
we did the same one.
We did the 2008, yeah.
Okay, yeah. And how did you sort of get into theatre then?
I've been a writer all my life.
Okay.
I studied English literature.
Right.
So, you know, what do you do? We've got loads of words. What are you going to do? Most of my year have become writers and, you know, actually journalists as well.
Yeah.
So I studied literature and came back to London and started writing. Just started. And in the last 25 years of, you know, being in, I suppose, in the workforce, I've been a journalist. I've actually done some arts criticism, not as much as you've done. But you're like, because one of my issues was, let's tell our story in the way in which you were excited when you saw the play. I came back to London and noticed there was a whole change in the culture in the 80s, because I'd been to university in Sheffield. So I was really excited and I wanted to just document that. That was my thing. I wanted to document the African experience, first of all in prose, non-fiction. And I'm basically doing the same thing in dramatic fiction now, trying to tell the story for the record, because I feel like we're always untold.
Yeah, and
unwritten.
It's something that's of interest to you, which is the best motivation for writing. How about you, Janice? How did you get into sort of theatre?
Strange, because I started in radio.
Oh,
yeah, that was my first
Radio
4. And I don't know, it led from there. I met a few playwrights and I decided to write a play as they were doing. And then, but then I did it on an MA at UEA. And then I hooked up with Menagerie Theatre. And so my MA Peaks, which is the Goosey Suit, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all. So yeah, so it was late, and it kind of just sort of happened, really.
Yeah. You know. And Menagerie Theatre, tell us a bit about that.
Okay, so they're based in Cambridge. They are a touring theatre, and they initially workshopped a Goosey Soup, and then they from then on they liked it, tried to get funding, and then they hooked up with Soho, so now it's on in Soho.
Yeah.
But it's a long progression. It's taken, you know, a few years to get on since 2009.
Right.
So it's like, finally here.
Yeah.
So like Janice. Pandora Box is my first play, stage play.
Yeah.
But I've written other scripts, but not stage scripts.
Yeah.
So this is the first piece.
Yes,
I had a small thing with the Talawa Unzip that we did together.
Yeah.
That was a very short play.
Yeah.
But like you, it's amazing that our first plays are having this, you know, exposure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, Bola Belong is a co-production, isn't it?
Yeah, between Theatre Vaulty and the Royal Court, yeah.
Yeah. Can you give us a brief synopsis of the story, please?
So Belong is a play about a British politician. Well, he's Nigerian, so he grew up in Nigeria and then came here to study in his early 20s and then just ended up staying here. So he's a black politician, and the play opens with he had just lost his seat at the election, and he's completely devastated and just can't hide how he feels, and it's because of the way that he ran his campaign. And so he just decides that he's going to go back to Nigeria for a break. And when he goes back to Nigeria, he gets involved in African politics, so to speak, and also family politics, because he arrives home and there's this boy who's also a politician in Nigeria, who his mother has taken under the wings and has kind of taken his place, so to speak. So
yeah, because he calls her...
Yeah, he calls her mama. So, his Kunle is the other politician. He's a young politician, a bright spark, who mama believes is going to kind of rule Nigeria one of these days. And so the play's just about Kayode, the lead, who's searching for that sense of belonging and trying to figure out what is home. And, you know, things have gone so bad for him here in England that he thought that, okay, I could start all over again over there, because no one knows you, you know,
certainly.
You don't have a reputation. But he has this passion to kind of change the world. And, and it's just about figuring out, everyone's figuring out their sense of belonging, because Kunle, the younger politician, also has to kind of fit in because he was adopted by Mama, but he had a poor upbringing and Mama's a wealthy family. And yeah, he's got to try and figure out where he belongs in that dynamic. And yeah,
okay. Pandora's Box.
It's a story about, the plot is about taking children from British-born African heritage children back to either Africa or the Caribbean.
Yeah.
The story is really about choices parents have to make for their children.
Yeah.
And the fact that I feel to an extent maybe parenting today, we think the children have to help decide.
Mm.
And I don't know if that's a good shift or a bad one.
Yeah, and it's one that you explore, because what's the situation?
A mother is on holiday with her son in Lagos, and she's gone to join, in her story, similar to mine, an elder sibling. She's staying with an elder sibling who's the daughter that was left behind when the parents came to the UK. And they've all decided before leaving London that they're going to leave this young man. Mm. He's not in any trouble, the police aren't after him, but he's a bit, not quite studying, not quite getting into the things they thought he should get into at that stage. So they've hatched this plot to put him into a very strict Nigerian boarding school. I don't even know much about Nigerian schools. The word they use often is rugged, and that means it's tough. To the extent that children are beaten, children are flogged, and it's not unusual. And it's a situation that someone born here like me would find really like, whoa, for a child, that's a bit extreme.
Yeah, and it's like almost, to us, 19th century.
But it is, those
that
schools,
kind of boarding school, very
strict.
You
hit it on the head. They're actually founded, most of those schools, by missionaries. Yeah. Exactly what you said. They're the remainder of, if you like, the British colonial public school education system. In Africa, as you know, in Australia, in places like that, those fossils still remain. Yeah. So it's that kind of thing.
Yeah, when I went to Nigeria, ours was called Our Lady of Fatima.
Oh, wow.
A mixture of Catholic and Muslim.
It was crazy. But it was that experience where I just remember the first day they gave us a test, and this will always stay with me and my brother for the rest of our life. And so the teacher had marked the test, and obviously we were the British kids, so we were kind of the slowest one. So I think we got like the lowest grade. So I was just sitting there, and then they said, oh, stand up on the table, me and my brother. So we're the English kids that couldn't speak Yoruba, had to stand up on the table, and they started singing this song. And basically it's this song about how stupid and dumb you are and how that you're the dumbest in the class, basically. And we were like looking around, like I still remember the image. I remember what I was wearing. I remember, because we were just like, what
it's
is this?
It's a real culture
and
shock.
It was,
so she's got this fear for her child. You know, first of all, she's never lived in Nigeria, so she doesn't know what to expect. And she's thinking, my baby, I don't want people to smack my son. He may be a little bit naughty, but she doesn't realise the extent, the gravity of what he's actually got into in London.
Yeah, but that emerges.
It's actually 3 hours. Yeah. It's in real time, as it were, because the story starts 3 hours before they're due to get the plane, and in the middle of that, she goes through this huge argument, inner and external, with her family, with her friends. She's got a best friend who's travelled with her, about the pros and cons, if you like, of the upbringing you get, the rearing in Africa, and the kind of rearing we have in Europe. So in a sense, I'm just trying to examine the advantages and disadvantages that we get here and there. So it's a comparison, if you like.
Janice, your play.
Okay, so A Goosey Soup is about a family who are preparing for the sort of a commemoration service, which takes place in Nigeria. So it starts in London, and it takes place over 2 days. And there's two daughters. One of the daughters, she comes from America. She's a high-flying city lawyer.
That's Anne, is it?
And she realises, she comes home and everything's changed. You know, her sister Grace is married to a traditional Nigerian, which is surprising for her. And there's this dodgy pastor hanging about.
And he's very dodgy.
He's very dodgy.
Sometimes.
And you know what? I know people like this guy.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, in all of that setting, it's about what you were talking about earlier, about, you know, being of dual nationality and where do you actually belong?
Yeah.
You know? So it's really interesting.
Yeah, in fact, it seems to be a common theme, this
idea
of belonging.
Belong 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting because it's almost, it is universal in a way, while I said, this thing about, it's a cliche, identity, we hear it all the time. But it is present in our lives. You know, we live in this world which is so interconnected now. It's an opportunity for us, because it's great that we can get on EasyJet and jump here and jump there. But that does throw up all sorts of questions.
Yep.
When the world was sealed, you didn't have the same tensions because you didn't have exposure to all the different competing
exactly.
cultures.
Yeah.
So it's that competing thing, which is an opportunity, but also a stress and a tension. Mm-hmm. And if you have in your own front room, one of the tags we've used for my plays, two continents, one front room.
Yeah.
It's like in there, it's not outside the front door, it's in your own home.
Yeah, that, and that could
us,
apply to the
yeah,
other two plays.
I just think it's
and that's mileage for us as dramatists.
But for
yeah.
every human being, you want to belong. It's just
yeah.
like fundamental
yeah,
instinct.
Yeah,
yes.
that's right.
But it's, and you're forced to, I mean, like with belong, part of what I was exploring as well is that, like with Kayode's wife Rita, who is Nigerian, but she doesn't, it's like what you said about
yeah.
being, but like she doesn't identify with that world at all. And
yeah.
it's just the outside world that's forcing her to identify with that world. And I thought that that was, I mean, that fascinates me because for a long time I was that person. I was that, I'm not Nigerian. I turned
yeah.
my back on it. And
yeah.
I always say, like, I do plays like this because I am making up. I'm proud
yeah.
to be being Nigerian now.
Yeah.
But I feel like I have to kind of
I'm the opposite.
Run and kind of make up for the fact that I'd turned my back on
it. I was almost the other extreme. I was so embracing of Nigeria. I was in denial about my Englishness. Now listen to me. How can I be in denial? But that's what I was in this myth fiction thing of I'm African. And I really embraced it. And people say, hang on, when have you lived in Africa? And I'd be, oh, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So I'm the opposite. I really wanted to be African. And I always thought, oh, they've had such a good deal. They live in Africa. They've got this, they've got that. I felt inferior to my sisters in Nigeria because I was born and raised in London.
Yeah. I was like, Bola, I had no desire to know about my Nigerian side at all up until, you know, my 20s,
yeah.
my 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And now
university
I love it.
Days,
yeah.
yeah.
Well, mine's even after, you know, because just, yeah, you know, way after. But,
okay. Each of your plays is a family story. Can you talk a bit about the differences between family life here and in Nigeria?
Well, I've always been fascinated by parent-child stories.
Yeah.
So even if I'm writing, and I haven't yet, a story about a workplace, I will, I'm sure in my mind, conceive of it, of the relationship between, you know, parents or people who are adults and the people who are junior to them.
Mm.
So I like the family because I think it's a microcosm of society. It gives you the opportunity to explore all sorts of different relationships and dynamics. And for the African family, again, because of this thing about the fracturing, you know, we are here because of empire.
Mm.
You know, Africans are around the world, scattered because
yeah.
of slavery, because of imperialism.
Yeah.
All those forces have led to this fracturing in the global family sense, but also in the individual family sense.
Mm.
Our parents left Africa because they were looking to do... They thought the opportunities would... Anyway, lots of different reasons.
Yeah.
So I think it's just a brilliant starting point to explore all sorts of other themes, such as belonging, but also, you know, power. I'm interested
yeah.
in power relationships.
Yeah.
Parents and children are like differences, the difference between those who have the say and those who don't. So
mm.
there's one debate in my play, which is about letting the child decide for themselves. Because the
yeah.
child, is the boy, is saying, I don't want to stay.
Yeah.
And the adults in Nigeria are saying, you don't let the child choose.
yeah.
You know, the child is there to be told what to do. They're seen and not heard, which is how we were raised.
Yeah.
So it's about power relationships
yeah.
within a family setting.
And you've got the same thing in your play, haven't you, Bola? The sort of different authority.
Yeah, Mama is the... She is the... she's the lady of the house. She takes
Mama.
Control, yeah. And she's the one that... She told at the Kayode is like 45, but she still tells him what to do, and he has to listen to her. And I find that that's just... It's funny though, because that isn't my relationship with my mum and dad. I think I am, like, when my sisters first came over, they used to moan a lot and say that we were raised differently.
Mm.
And they used to always complain and go,
you
don't,
away with
yeah,
it.
We got away with it. That was always my sister's biggest complaint. And I find that I've got more of a friendship relationship with my mum and dad. And even when things go wrong and we quarrel, and my dad's like, oh, I'm telling you, I don't live at home anymore. So, like, my dad would be on the other line and go, well, I'm telling you, I'm like, Dad, I've got to go, buy it. Do you know, it's not, there isn't that kind of,
yeah.
And sometimes I think to myself, oh, actually, was I a bit rude? Do I need to kind
yeah.
of apologise?
Were you
raised
prostrating? Did you do
it? No, I didn't do all of that. So,
yeah. But it's in your play, though, isn't
yeah,
it?
It's in my play because of, obviously, being back in Nigeria, and that's how it is. But I do remember family, friends coming over, and they'll go, oh, you need to bend down and greet me, and you know, greet me correctly. And my mum would be like, well, I don't force them to do it here, so why would they do it for you?
And that's an issue in the play, because the son is saying that.
Yeah.
Why would I do it? I don't do it in London. And his mum's saying, well, you just do it while you're here, just to go and play along.
Yeah, and I think that that's quite an interesting... You are raised differently when you grow up here.
Yeah. Janice, yeah, is it the same in your play as well?
To a certain extent, but what I'm exploring is, yeah, the same thing, where you cut the tie, because, you know, you can be 80 and parents are 100 and they'll be still telling you, you know, you've got to do this. And so that's what's happening in my play, is, you know, whether you fulfil the wishes of your parents or not. But the thing is, though, Nigerian children, I think, value the wishes of their parents. I feel a lot more, you know, I used to... discuss that with my uni mates, you know, and they'd never understood, you know, oh, you know, my mum wants this, my mum wants that, and they're like, who cares, you know, who cares, but we really do care about their wishes.
And is that good or bad is another issue, because the extent to which family is stronger, arguably, in Africa, is a benefit, but then it means individual freedoms are curtailed, because you're the deference, not just the prostration, but the general
deference. Yeah, but
deference
the deference
elders,
can also be a form that doesn't actually mean that you have to do everything that your betters tell you. Is that right?
Yes, and... Well,
I don't know. See, I've always said... It's quite funny because, like, even just as being a playwright and people and being a Nigerian or a black playwright, people always go to me, oh, so did your are your parents happy that you're writing? Are your parents happy that you're in the arts? And my parents have never had... It's not that they wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer or anything like that, because... But then I realised that it's because my sister, who's a couple of years older, she was the one that had to go through that battle at college, you know, picking the courses, and my dad saying, no, do this. And she's like, I like to sing, I like to dance, I like to act, I want to do that. And it was only recently that my sister actually pointed out and goes, I fought the battles for you. Because when it came down to mine, once she'd got away with, you know, picking drama instead of picking double science... it was easier for me. So us three, the youngest kids, we've never had that issue of you have to
it's
be
very
this
interesting.
And you have to be that.
I think my mum was probably very unorthodox, and I'm not even aware of how unorthodox she was, because she didn't ever say
you had
do
to
X or Y.
Yeah.
My mum had a dog, a Nigerian with a dog.
Yeah.
It was in the 80s. She had pets. I'm thinking, that's quite weird when you look back on it.
Yeah.
So my mum never gave us any... In fact, you know what? Five children, get on with it. You're on your own. Every man for himself.
I was head direction. I was going to be a lawyer. And, you know, my brother's going to be an engineer. You know, we're all going to be something about, you know, what else is there? Lawyer, doctor, engineer.
Yeah.
Accountant. You know, the big five.
Yeah. Now, I think in each of your plays, fascinatingly, there's the concept of white-black people.
Yeah.
Do you use that as well?
No, I didn't use that terminology, but when Kaede goes to Nigeria, he is called Oyinbo completely. Like, they just don't identify him as a Nigerian.
Yeah.
He's constantly referred to as an Englishman.
Well, that's what happens to us, so yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I was just repeating what I've experienced.
Yeah, and is that also the same for you as well?
Not specifically.
Yours is set here, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you don't have that.
Yeah.
Sorry,
okay.
No.
Yeah,
cool. In Lagos, they used to say Black American," whenever, you know, when I was very young.
Yeah, yeah.
And you think, why do they always think it's... Because they had no concept, really, of us as a group outside of Nigeria.
Yeah. I was just always called, the English one. That's what my mum used to say. And my mum reminded me, she said once, my brother was fighting outside, so he was about five, and this kid came running, and he came running, and he came in, and he said, it's the alien that's fighting, it's the alien. And my mum was just like, who's the alien? And then she realised, oh, she's talking about her son, like, he's the alien. And that was quite fun. But then growing up, you had to kind of... You automatically you stood out, and that's what I find kind of fascinating. That here I do feel Nigerian, but I know the minute I step over and I get off the plane, my cousins say it to me all the time: "You're not really Nigerian.
No.
You don't live there. You're not a true Nigerian."
But the interesting thing is, one of the scenarios I've encountered, having done the research, is that the kids, and there are quite a few now, more and more, who are being plucked out of the UK and sent back, shipped home, deported. They're sometimes called.
Yeah.
They are almost like celebrities these days. Because there's a whole thing about... I mean, there's always been the vogue of Black American, African American. But now there's a sense Tiny Temper is big, you know, really, really popular. You know, he's Nigerian heritage, born in South London, I think, your area.
Mm.
So those kids, a lot of them, are like celebrities in some of the schools. I was in Ghana over Christmas, and I met two London boys on Christmas Day. And they were telling me that in the schools, they were like, everyone wanted to have pictures taken with them, and they'd just been suddenly dumped in the school. And they didn't like it, because they were reluctant to have left London, but they said, we're really special here.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting.
Another thing I think that you'll mention or imply, this idea of Britain failing.
Yeah.
And Nigeria rising, new African sort of century and so on. Can you talk a bit about that?
For me, it's because, I mean, Belong's quite timely for me, because I know a lot of people my age who have decided to go back to Nigeria. And it is because they felt that, okay, I'm just not getting anywhere here. It's the frustration. You know, you hear it on the news. It's wherever you turn, you're reminded that things are not great over here. Whereas you look over abroad and you see people in Nigeria, people that set up businesses and are doing well. And it's almost like people feel that you can start all over again. It's that second chances opportunity. And what I admire the most about Nigeria, the most, is the fact that you can become anything, and the issue of your blackness is removed completely.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And I think that fascinates me quite a lot, especially, you know, as my career progresses and stuff. I'm always reminded of how black I am, regardless of, you know, I look in the mirror every day, but I'm still always the black playwright. And sometimes I do feel that I'm not measured against other playwrights because of that. You know, it's almost like, yeah, you're good for being the black one. You're not good as a playwright as a whole. And so that issue of going back to a world where you're not a minority, you're a majority, it fascinates me a lot. And I think that a lot of people are having those feelings and are having those kind of, like, the ceilings are not there, and you know that the ceilings are not there in Africa.
My first job in journalism was working for a Nigerian news magazine, which was like the equivalent of Newsweek. And so I was always very aware of, if you like, the African scenario, because it was actually looking at the whole of the African political and economic landscape. So I was kind of very early on plugged into the opportunities in Africa. And as I said, I was in London working, then I went to America. And it's always been in my head that, yes, there are, even before this notion of Africa's rise, which is, you know, 2-3 years now, I had always had a sense that when my son was at a certain age, he's now 22, let him get through college, etc., I would probably do some business in Nigeria, because I'm interested in stories, you know, having trained in Hollywood, stories that really do travel around the world. So it's exciting what's happening, but I think even without all the hype, and it's not just hype, there are countries that are really forging ahead, but that's also based on the population explosion in different parts of Africa. There was an article just a few days ago about Lagos's population just
escalating.
It's incredible what's happening. Yeah. It's going to be it's going to be the third largest city in about 10, 15 years.
Wow.
There was a piece in the Times. It's a special supplement they produced on the mega cities of tomorrow. I was just reading it yesterday. So that's really quite a thing.
Yeah, and it changes your idea of the whole of the world, really.
It's not, it's not minority. Those words don't apply anymore. That's that language is not happening.
Yeah.
It's a whole Kenya has got, I think, 75 million, and 60% of them are under 25. And that's the pattern across Africa. The demographics mean in Europe we're aging, in America we're aging, but it's the youthfulness of Africa which is the real gold. It's the youthfulness. One tiny thing, I've got my story set in the home of a Nigerian socialite and entrepreneur. So she is the person who is, if you like, in the thick of this whole explosion of the economic potential. She's building telecoms industries.
Yeah.
I was thinking about what you said about failing, Britain failing my characters.
Yeah,
play. And I think in respect to beauty and attractiveness, that's where I addressed it, how I think perhaps in being British, being a black British woman might be a bit different. You're perceived a bit differently from, say, white British woman. And so I sort of explored that a little bit.
But also, you talk a lot about religion and the Celestial Church of Christ.
Yes.
Can you tell me a bit about that?
That's an interesting church. For my research, I went along to a few sessions. And it's a sort of amalgamation of Christianity and traditional practices. It's more Yoruba church, actually. It's not really Igbo. So and it's sort of one of those churches that, you know, to get what you want, you have to sort of defeat your enemies. I think enemies are working against you. So it's a white garmented church. I mean, you must have, lots of people would notice them around.
No shoes.
And, I mean, it's an interesting church. It's about getting what you want, basically.
Well, and also in your play, you've got a lot about this kind of ceremony for conceiving a child, which is kind of comical, but it's also a bit sort of...
that stuff is
a bit scary.
You know, it's real. You believe in doing all these little things. I mean, you can eat... I won't give away that, because I think that's the best scene in the play. So I won't give away about much about that. But, you know... They have sort of blessed food and stuff like that, and if they eat it or do things with it, then that will get what they want.
It's traditional, because traditional churches is traditionalist ideology mixed with Christianity. Because obviously when the Christian Crusades went to Africa, they had their ways of doing it, and the way in which they could encourage them to kind of get on board, even with Islam. Islam's got its, they still got their things and their ways where they, some Muslims still practice traditional kind of ideas in terms of, you know, going to an alpha and having a guy read your kind of palms and whatever and stuff like that. And yeah, it's just the way that Africans mix that culture. And what I find fascinating, we cut it from my play actually, the issues of not Christianity but about religion, because Mama is, she's Muslim, but it's that thing of and there was a line that I really was fighting to keep it in, but it just didn't, it was another story in itself, so there was, you know, that's another play, but it was about the fact that Africans take on religion so much, and it's that thing of, because of the situation and because of the way in which, you know, the world is for them, you have to find that other, you have to have hope in that other. And because they do, they always say, there's this comment I always read all the time, which is about Nigerians are the most happiest people in the world. And that is because they have this hope for something better is going to come along. I am working towards something better. No matter what my situation is, the better will come, because I need to believe in God. And the way that the Christian Crusade and the Islam Crusades had kind of taken over Africa as a whole is a fascinating thing.
Yeah, it is.
Completely.
I don't know if it's going back a bit, but I was just thinking about Africa Rise as well, in terms of the way in which we as Nigerians are so different to other parts of Africa. We have 150 million officially. There are some nations with only 2 million. So the notion of Africa's rise is especially important for the Nigerian scenario, because we are like the powerhouse of Africa. It's between us and South Africa, people say. And South Africa's got 40 million, Ghana's got 24 million.
Wow.
So that's why for us as Nigerian writers, I think that we have a special sense of that expanding universe of opportunity. It's not the same for Zambians. You know, we've got to make sure there's that distinction between different parts of Africa.
Of course. Yeah,
but as Nigerians, though, we're kind of taught, like, I don't ever remember, it's a sense of pride that's embedded in you. And I don't ever remember ever not feeling that sense of pride. You know, my parents, that's the Europe thing, that's part of the thing. Yeah, Europe is the thing that they struggled the most with when they came here, which was that they were Nigerian. They were never going to be ashamed of it or to kind of turn their backs on it. The way they dressed, the way they talked, they were going to keep and stick to that. And that's why sometimes I feel with my generation is that that sense of pride for a period of time was missing. Because my parents never stopped speaking Yoruba. They never stopped dressing in their traditional clothes. It was my generation that completely turned our back away from it. And then now it's coming back again. Like my sister, who's 17, she speaks a lot more Yoruba than I do. And I live there and she's never lived there. But it's because that thing of, you know, she's like, she doesn't understand that I went to school and said that I wasn't Nigerian.
It's interesting, get it? Because that issue of European, not just Britain, but the European crisis, you know, that's happening. One of my themes is to explore the extent to which, if we want to really own the UK, we've got to say, well, we invest ourselves and our skills and our training here. And there's a character who's basically renouncing Europe.
Yeah.
And one of the older Nigerian characters is saying, England raised you. England educated you. England fed you. Nigeria didn't. You should invest and be grateful.
Yeah, that's
so that's a debate that I've been having in my head.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to just skip off, because I feel a certain loyalty. I don't feel very much the Englishness. But the Londonness, this is my city.
Yeah,
you know, this is my place. So I got a sense of wanting to really invest in London and help develop London. But also I have a sense of loyalty to Nigeria too.
Language. Can you talk a bit about the language you use in your plays? Because also you do use, well, I wouldn't know what, whether it's Yoruba.
Mine's Yoruba.
I've got a cast, I'm so lucky. Sorry, my cast are actually, a lot of them are native Yoruba speakers.
Oh, right. Okay.
So they help me, and I've got to acknowledge them.
Yeah.
Tunji Shoti Mirin, who plays Baba. Yetunde Oduwale, who plays the socialite entrepreneur sister. they just brought so much of the, if you like, the real flavour to the play. Mm. So I've been really fortunate they've actually put it in there, and they can speak it properly, so the Nigerian audience will get it.
Yeah.
Yeah, mine's a mix of Yoruba and Igbo.
So okay.
Yeah, because there's a cultural clash between the two in my play.
And talk me through that. I mean, what is the clash? What?
Tribalism. Say what you have with the English and the Scots or something. Yeah. It's just, you know, we think we are better than them. And so, one, say Grace has married a traditional Yoruba man, who I love, you know, you know, Grace's mother thinks he's just not good enough. He's not, you know, they're a bit lazy, they're a bit, you know, uneducated. But I'm sure they'll have the same about
us.
We think you're really industrious. You guys are like, wow, they work so hard.
But they say they work so hard and they'll rip you off is what
the
comments
are.
Never trust an Igbo man.
No way.
Yeah, and never marry an Igbo man because they'll take the land back. When the man dies.
Do you know what? I've got something about Yoruba in my play about you guys doing that to us.
That's how Igbo men do it. So you better know where it is.
Stop!
Right. But is there a religious dimension to Igbo and Yoruba?
Most Igbos are
Christian.
Yeah. And a lot of Yorubas are Muslim.
And not Catholic as well, aren't they?
Yeah, Catholic Christians. Yeah.
So that obviously increases the antagonism.
Yeah.
Do you think it's a good time now to be a British Nigerian writer?
Seems so.
Yeah, it seems.
It's exciting.
Yeah,
it seems exciting. Going through the tube last year and seeing those Fela posters. Whatever people think of the production, I think it had lots of strengths, some areas for development. But to see that recognition of our Bob Marley, called,
of course.
In the tube, didn't you get a sense of, wow, that's fantastic?
Yeah.
So and Nollywood has done this. Nollywood has put the Nigerian story on the landscape. I think that's been...
And also, it's not even just with the theatre and films. I mean, it's music as well. Music is completely blowing up and taking over. And I just feel that it is a nice time. And I always say, I wish I was my sister's age now, because she can absorb it. She can absorb it all in.
But she can.
I'm 31 soon.
Oh, gosh. Next month. Shock horror. You've been clearing your throat. You're where I'm facing. No, you're right.
It's not a coincidence the three of us are going on at the same time, but there's just been so many Nigerian things on at the moment this year that it's just been...
But again, we can't ignore the fact of demographics. There are too many of us in the world not to make an impact.
Yeah.
You know, there are 50 million Nigerians. It's a bit like the Indian scenario with, you know, Bollywood promoted and exported Indian culture because they have diasporas everywhere who are receptive to it
and
wanted to consume that culture. Yeah. Do you think it's the same for us?
Yeah, I do. And then, there was a review recently that was in what review was it? What's On Stage? And the guy said about the thing that obviously you always pick at the bad things, don't you? And so he said something of my play, and he said, "Oh, this is her third installment in. We would want less of the Yoruba slang." And that was the little thing that I picked up the most. Less of the Yoruba slogan, because you know, most of my play, like Gone Too Far, had a bit of Yoruba in it, and this play does.
Yeah, just the odd sort of line
that was. But it annoyed me that he said that, because I just thought that, you know, I'm gonna write about my culture, and I shouldn't hold back and make it an English play.
Also, you write in the rhythm of that. The different characters speak in a different rhythm.
I was going to put a whole scene of Yoruba in. Yeah. It was just in the end I thought, okay, not now, next time.
But the first wife, there was loads of them.
But I don't think I don't think people should see this as a niche and go, okay, well, there's three Nigerian plays on this month, that's it for the rest of the year, or that's it next year. But it can go like that, because it can be like, we've had enough of it. And one thing that I want to make clear, and you know, is the point, is that I'm not going away from this culture, and I'm not going to not want to tell stories of, and it's not that I'm telling these same stories, because it is different stories, and although our plays have the same themes, they're not the same plays, and they tackle the issues from different angles.
It's so weird. Things like with Mike McDonagh, they would say, oh, not another Irish play.
No one would say, oh, we've got Thomas Middleton, so we don't need we've got Shakespeare.
But it's strange, but I think that's a difficulty.
Okay, one more slightly more challenging question though. I notice all of your plays tell the story straightforward in a linear form. Have you considered writing, you know, in a more experimental way? There's no reason why you shouldn't, but there's no reason obviously why you should. But have you thought about that?
I'm a fan of the well-made play, and this has always been something I've challenged myself on. I just happen to really enjoy, personally, that kind of structure, that kind of form. And you could say formula, that's not a nice word, but I know
form, I think
it's form.
But why not formula if it works?
Well, if it works, but also...
And if the story can be told like that.
But at the same time, I think as a writer, I also want to experiment and explore and grow. So it's to answer the question, at this point, I think maybe that's where I might begin to think about adapting. And also not just in terms of, if you like, European avant-garde experimental, but, you know, we've got heritage to draw on. African storytelling forms. I don't think I know as much as I could do about those traditions.
I want to expand that, just the, and also about the way that Nigeria, because the, in Brazil, they still practice a lot of the Yoruba traditional. And I've been reading a couple of books about that. And, yeah, that's something I want to explore. And, it's, you know, the issues of the gods and things like that and the belief system.
Because, in a sense, we're bringing new material to the table as our British African story is now being told. But there's also form to be explored. Not just the content, you know, but our way
but of also, I mean, if, you know, you admit that there's a magical element to some aspects of Nigerian culture, then you blow apart this whole idea of the linear play and naturalism. You could have gods, you could have fantasies,
dreams. And that's something
dreams.
I'm very interested in.
I don't know how theatres here would react to it, but,
you
know.
But there's something in the African-American tradition, you know, the idea of anagogy.
Yeah.
Because I'm really interested in James Baldwin's style of that very prophetic type of storytelling. And it's the anagogic voice which I would like to get to. And it maybe is through that spiritual religious layer, or it might be not. It might be just a way of actually almost like Suzanne Lurie Parks. Oh my gosh. It's almost like prophecy, but it's drama.
Yeah.
So I would love to find a way to include that kind of voice and energy, but also still tell a story.
Terrell McRaney does that as well. Like the
it's the same
of,
kind
the use of
quality.
African mythology and how he embeds that into the stories that he tells today.
Okay, thank you very much, Bella
Ade
Janice.
Thank you. Yeah.